Once upon a time, Amazon Music met audiobooks, and listeners everywhere rejoiced.
Oh, yeah.
Because now they could listen to one audiobook title a month from an enormous library of popular audiobook titles, including Romantasy, Autobiographies, True Crime, and more. Suddenly, listeners didn't mind sitting in traffic or even missing their flight. Amazon Music Unlimited now includes Audible.
No way.
Download the Amazon Music app now to start listening. Terms apply.
I came from a beautiful neighborhood. I had a beautiful life.
I went to sleep because September 7th was the first day of my high school year. I was going to be a senior.
At 22, I was set to start college.
I woke up and my life was never the same again.
Cops came out with guns drawn and I never saw freedom ever since after that.
It's like Roach Motel. Once you get in, you're not getting out.
I'm Jason Flom. Today we'll be talking to Fernando Bermudez.
A young man sent away for the rest of his life.
They arrested him and they threw away the keys. They never did another bit of investigation.
Accusations of police.
In 1991, Fernando Bermudez was arrested for the murder of a 16-year-old boy in Greenwich Village, even though he was 5 miles away with his friends and had multiple alibi witnesses who placed him far away from the scene of the crime.
A young lady said that I looked cute and that was enough for her to share the pictures and for the witnesses to communally agree that I resembled the perpetrator.
He was convicted anyway and sentenced to 23 years to life in maximum security prisons in New York State. This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom. Fernando, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jason, for having me.
So I want to talk to you about what your life was like, what happened, what went wrong, what you learned from it, and where you're at now. So let's go back to 1991.
Major cities in the nation are under attack from within. Nowhere are the problems more visible than in New York City. Bob Fall reports.
New York has gotten so mean and so dangerous, the mayor actually went to church yesterday and pleaded with residents to come out from behind locked doors.
Well, 1991 was a year where New York City was crime-ridden. The homicide rates were, on average, 2,000 per year. And it was a time where I think the city was transitioning into a intention to get tough on crime.
I lived in New York my whole life, and so I remember the only thing growing faster than the crime rate was the hysteria over the crime rate, right? I mean, it wasn't like everybody was being killed or mugged, or, but it seemed like it at the time. So, but how were you doing back then? What were you? Were you in high school, college at the time? What was your family situation? Where'd you live?
I lived in Washington Heights, a predominantly Dominican neighborhood, mixed with a lot of immigrants who had moved to the other side of Upper Manhattan. And yet there was certainly a commingling of ethnic groups and so forth. But for myself, I was 22 years old at the time, and you know, I was a happy person growing up in a close-knit family, 4 siblings, 2 parents who worked hard to achieve the American dream as Dominican immigrants in coming to this country. And at 22, I was set to start college.
So what? Let's talk about the night that your life took such a terrible turn. Let's talk about the crime itself and then where you were and how you got mixed up in this nightmare.
Well, the crime itself, according to documented evidence, is that there was a shooting at a nightclub, the Mark Ballroom in the Greenwich Village section. The Mark Ballroom, yes, sir. And it was near NYU. And so this kid named Ephraim Lopez, 16, who had absconded from a work release program, had gotten punched by another guy named Raymond Blount.
Inside the club.
Outside, Ephraim Lopez had wanted revenge after telling his friend from the West 90s neighborhood who had punched him. So,
Ephraim Lopez. So it was 2 different groups of kids.
Yes.
Right. And they wanted to start something.
Yeah, Ephraim Lopez had been punched, though. He was embarrassed and wanted revenge. And so he told his friends from the West 90s neighborhood, not only inside that he had gotten punched, but also outside he identified the person who had punched him. So a melee ensued in which Raymond Blount's friends were attacked by Ephraim Lopez's friends and his group from the West 90s. And in that confusion, under nighttime conditions conducive to mistaken eyewitness identification, Raymond Blount was shot.
And killed.
And killed.
Right. And so what happens next? So now we have a murder. It's near NYU. That puts a lot of pressure on the cops, right? So you're, where were you at the time of the
murder? So at the time, I'm actually uptown near where I lived.
Did you have alibi witnesses?
Yes, absolutely. And that's definitely part of the story because we were together driving throughout the city in a car that I had just newly acquired. It was like that same day, August 3rd and 4th, I had just gotten that car and it was sort of like
a gift.
Well, it was a big day, not just that the car was out for the first time, but also that was the car that I was going to use to go to college, to drive to for my home, which was right across in the Bronx where I was going to go to college. And we were driving around enjoying ourselves, oblivious to anything that had happened. And at the time when the actual crime occurred, we were uptown in my neighborhood driving around.
And so when did you first come in contact with the authorities? How did that happen?
August 6, 1991.
So this is a couple weeks?
2 days.
Oh, 2 days.
Right after the murder.
Right.
And I'm driving home. I'm with my brother. And we had actually met two young ladies that night.
I'm not surprised.
It was another, you know, good moment, and we was driving home when suddenly cops came out with guns drawn and pointed them at the window, and everyone just screamed.
You were at a traffic light?
No, we were in front of my home. Oh. Right, we drove. The cops had been waiting for me.
Uh-huh.
They had been upstairs speaking to my mother and my siblings, and when my mother said that I should be coming home shortly, they positioned themselves outside. So when we came out, they drew their guns and told me to get out the car, and I never saw freedom ever since after that.
So obviously you're 22, and you're scared out of your mind, and they take you in. They tell you you've been charged with murder. Is that right?
That's correct. I was taken to the 6th precinct, and it's interesting because I was so scared. Everyone was so scared. I just got out. I complied, and I got in the car, and then when they took me away, the girl was saying, "I thought you were a nice guy," and I screamed back, "I am." You know, and I was taken to the precinct. I was interrogated for over 10 hours, and they wanted to know my whereabouts on the night of August 3rd and 4th, 1991. I told them who I was with. I told them that under no circumstances I was involved in any violence. I told them what I was wearing.
Now, 10 hours, that's a long time to be interrogated. So did they get you to confess?
No, I didn't confess. For me, it was a surreal experience. I just felt that if I told the truth, that it would be resolved. If I was just patient, that it would be resolved. All I needed to do was remember who I was, what I did, who I was with, and it would be resolved. And
that's interesting to hear you say that, Fernando, because there's a lot of distrust among the Latino community of police. Nationally, I think the figure 69% of Latinos will actually even call the police if they're a victim of a crime or if they witness a crime, because there is that distrust. But you felt differently. You felt that the police were on your side and that if you were truthful, that everything would work out. Is that right?
Well, absolutely. Cops, for me, at that point, were heroes to me. I mean, I had gotten, it's an interesting anecdote, when I was about maybe 10 years old, I had found my father's stolen car. And we went to the 34th precinct in our local neighborhood, and the cops gave me a bag of jelly beans and put the cop hat on me, and they said, "Good job for finding my father's stolen car." So I admired them, and plus they were protecting my community.
As a 10-year-old, that's a big moment in anybody's life. Yeah, I mean, A, you helped out your dad, you solved a crime, and the cops are giving you big props. I'm not surprised then that you had a lot of faith in the system. What happens next?
So because I refused to confess, I was taken to the Manhattan Tombs, central booking, in other words, and I was processed, I was arraigned, I pled not guilty. And from then on, hours later, I was sent to Rikers Island, where my nightmare really began in earnest.
So you're in Rikers Island. Now your nightmare is fully underway. I mean, I think this is everyone's nightmare.
Absolutely. I had to go into survival mode because all around me, I mean, people were fighting over the phones to make phone calls. I mean, the phones were racially divided. Two phones, one Latino and one Black. And anyone who crossed those lines to use those phones would be cut in the face, smashed in the face with a phone. These are things I actually saw. And it was black market operations. There were burgeoning gangs and what would become groups like Latin Kings and stuff like that. And I was terrified. I just tried to mind my business. And all along in my heart, I still felt that the American criminal justice system would prevail if I stayed patient.
Was there bail set in your case?
No bail.
So you had no hope of getting out before your trial. How long did it take you to get to trial?
My trial took about 7 months to get underway.
So you're locked up for 7 months, taken away from your family, taken away from your life, put into this devastating circumstance. Let's just talk about the jail for a minute. Rikers Island is technically classified as a jail, even though what people don't understand is that many jails like Rikers are actually more dangerous than maximum security prisons. So in those 7 months, what went through your mind?
Sure. Well, I was there over a year, but it took 7 months to get to my trial. And, during the whole, year and change that I was there, I mean, I was deeply affected by just seeing the violence perpetrated by not just inmates on inmates, but correctional officers attacking inmates and even inmates attacking correctional officers. When you see someone get stabbed with sewing machine efficiency, there's something in you that dies and yet lives. It affects your psyche in a way that you're never the same because you see another human being injured in a way that just makes an impression, a bad impression in your life.
And there's nothing you can do about it.
There's nothing you can do about it, even if it happens to be someone that you knew and even shared a meal with for some reason.
Were you, when you went in, would you consider yourself a tough guy? Were you a guy who could handle himself in a fight? Were you, Fernando is a guy who keeps himself in very good shape, but I don't know you back then. I've known you now for 6 or 7 years. So, were you equipped to deal with this situation in any way?
Well, mentally, I wasn't equipped. Physically, perhaps I had a better fighting chance than a more scrawnier person. I mean, I was a bodybuilder at the time. And that's what would make also the distinction in this case in terms of the identification procedure and why they even made me sit down. They described the perpetrator by the witnesses themselves. The perpetrator was described as 5'10", 165 pounds. I'm 6'2", weighing 220. And so they made me sit down in a lineup to hide the identification procedure. But for me, it was a matter of just trying to adjust because you couldn't even have a fair fight without getting jumped. That's what happened to me. When I was attacked, I was trying to defend myself against someone in one instance, and then his friends came and attacked me. I couldn't fight three guys.
And what happened then?
Well, they went into my locker and stole my food and the soap and deodorant that my parents brought me.
But were you badly beaten up at the time?
I wasn't that badly beaten up, but I was very embarrassed. And, it was a turning point because I was at a point where I was waiting for my trial to occur. I'm waiting for the American criminal justice system to work in my case. And I'm being patient. And this is something that really tries your patience. And once the Latino groups saw what had happened to me, someone tried to pass me a razor. And they said, you can resolve it this way. And I declined because I want to go home. Right. If I stab or hurt someone even worse, I could end up in prison even longer.
Yeah. I mean, you were already facing a very long sentence and you knew it at the time, right? So, and it's interesting too, the eyewitness identification, I just want to touch on that for a minute because there are a lot of tricks that they play, right? And we know that eyewitness identification is a factor in 75% of the DNA exonerations that have happened nationwide. So there's a lot of movement now, and the Innocence Project is spearheading this along with some other groups to reform how eyewitness identifications are done, everything from videotaping to other procedures, what we call a double blind. But in your case, they obviously just wanted to get you, and they were willing to do some dirty tricks in order to get a conviction. So they weren't really interested in the truth. Is that fair to say?
That's correct. I mean, as proven, the witnesses were placed in a room, these teenage witnesses at that, who had been beaten, who were hungry, who were tired, who were joking around, who by their own accounts did not want to be there. And they were placed in a room and allowed to just shift through pictures. And three friends of the deceased who were in a separate identification procedure correctly identified who would become the state star witness. And the four of the witnesses who were in another room selecting pictures then selected my picture and a 17-year-old young lady said that I looked cute, and that was enough for her to share the pictures and for the witnesses to communally agree that I resembled the perpetrator. And that was enough.
They looked at the pictures together?
Yes, that's, which is illegal.
Of course it's illegal.
It's one of the reasons I got exonerated.
Oh, my God. I've heard a lot, but I hadn't heard that particular story before. Being that I'm familiar with so many of these cases, but that's just straight crazy. So there you are, you're stuck there and you go to trial. You were represented by a public defender at the time. You weren't a wealthy guy, right?
I wasn't a wealthy guy, but my parents, got scared and they hired a private attorney based upon word of mouth, particularly because he spoke Spanish and he had a son named Fernando.
So that was like, for some reason, a sign.
And so they hired him, and, you know, he was hoodwinked from the start in that the prosecutor didn't turn over exculpatory evidence. And when he did turn over boxes of evidence, it was after my jury was selected. So this is where...
So he had no time.
No time. Even when he asked, he was not allowed.
Right. And we know that the Supreme Court ruled in Brady that they have to turn over exculpatory evidence. But it seems like it's almost routinely ignored by prosecutors, which is... shocking, should be shocking to everyone in America, right? I mean, yes. Everyone who watches TV, watches crime shows, knows that that's the responsibility of the prosecutor. And most people, I think, believe that the prosecutor wants to get the right guy and would want to get the right guy. Because who would want the wrong guy to still be out there, right? That's always crazy to me, Fernando, that when you, aside from the human tragedy of locking up the wrong person, the idea that the real perpetrator is out there and is going, in many cases, in almost all cases, is going to commit more mayhem, be responsible for more mayhem and hurt other people, should be enough motivation in itself for law enforcement to want to do the right thing. But obviously, in your case, that was not the case. I'm sure these guys were feeling a lot of pressure, so much crime, so many cases to deal with. They want to get it off their desk. You were victimized by that mentality and that lack of morality, I would say, as well. So now you're at trial. You have your alibi witnesses there. Were they called to the stand?
Yes, my alibi witnesses came forward. I testified, and even three friends of the deceased came forward and said that I wasn't the guy who shot their best friend.
And so then people are listening. They're going, well, wait a minute. Shouldn't that be enough? Wouldn't that be case closed, no?
Well, that's what I thought. That's what I had hoped. But what the jury didn't know, and I didn't even know until the investigation unraveled on my behalf, was that, for example, Ephraim Lopez, the state star witness, 16 years old, who knew the actual perpetrator, had told the police and prosecutors who actually committed the crime. But they suppressed that evidence and where he could be found in exchange for his false testimony. He named me as someone I totally was not, and the police still did not go investigate the neighborhood. He got, after over 20 hours of interrogation, an opportunity to escape from murder charges. And the witnesses, the teenage witnesses as well, in addition, who didn't know it from Lopez, but who did say that it was him, they got that part right. They had gotten charges dismissed on the eve of their trial. Two had unrelated criminal charges pending, which were dismissed right before my trial began.
So it's amazing that prosecutors have this much power, right? The fact is that people think that the judge has a lot of power, or that the police or the defenders have power. The fact is that an overwhelming amount of the power rests with the prosecutors, because they can decide whether to prosecute or drop charges against anyone for any reason. Is that right?
Yes, sir.
So it's interesting, because we know, everyone who follows is even aware of anything to do with criminal justice knows that you can't bribe a witness, right? But yet the state is able to offer the best bribe that there is, which is that, hey, you got a lot of trouble on your hands, kid, right? You're facing a murder charge, or you're facing an assault or other things. And you know what? We're just going to ask you to do us a little favor here. You know, tell us what we need to hear, and you can go home, and we're going to clean it up and keep it moving, right? I mean, what could be better than that? And I think that a lot of people would have trouble resisting that if they're looking at a long period in prison, a long, many, many years they're facing. They're scared, too, and they want to go home. And they go, well, I don't even know this guy, Fernando, but you know what? Screw him, you know? So I think that's something that's important for people to understand, people who are going to be serving on juries, people who are involved in the system in any way. I think they need to know that.
Well, absolutely. And it's also how the system sets up the vulnerability of, in this case, teenage witnesses, you know, who haven't even had their prefrontal cortex meant for good judgment even fully developed. In my case, for example, two of the witnesses, one of whom had one of the charges dismissed, told the prosecutor that they didn't want to come testify because they didn't believe I was the guy. And yet they were arrested, physically taken from their home as material witnesses.
Well, that doesn't sound kosher either. I mean, there's just there, so it was really a series of mistakes that led to your both deliberate and accidental, but mostly deliberate, right?
Yes.
So you get convicted. The moment of that, the jury coming back in, I can't imagine the pressure. But you're standing there. You're still hoping that this is going to be, you know, the system's going to work. And you're going to go home and try to forget this whole thing. But then they come back and they read off the verdict. And then what?
And at that moment, I just had an out-of-body experience because I couldn't believe that, you know, all my hopes and dreams were shattered in the American criminal justice system. I really had believed in the system. I told the truth honestly. And I was just shattered. I mean, my mother started crying. My six-year-old sister at that time fell to the floor, and my grandmother, she like nearly fainted. I couldn't turn around because the hand of the bailiffs was shifting me now to not being able to look at my family, but to look directly at the jury or the judge. And I was terrified. I didn't even feel like I was there. Like I felt my body, but I felt myself floating away.
Once upon a time, Amazon Music met audiobooks, and listeners everywhere rejoiced.
Oh, yeah.
Because now they could listen to one audiobook title a month from an enormous library of popular audiobook titles, including Romantasy, Autobiographies, True Crime, and more. Suddenly, listeners didn't mind sitting in traffic or even missing their flight. Amazon Music Unlimited now includes Audible.
No way.
Download the Amazon Music app now to start listening. Terms apply.
In the aftermath of a transformative election like the one we just had, it's hard to read the news without asking yourself every 5 seconds, how did we get here? That's exactly what we're always trying to figure out on Fiasco, a history podcast from the co-creators of Slow Burn. In our first season, Bush v. Gore, we examine an unmistakable turning point in American politics, the 2000 election, which came down to a recount in Florida and ended with one of the most controversial rulings in Supreme Court history. In many ways, it's the beginning of the story we're living through right now. So if you're trying to make sense of the present moment, check out Fiasco, Bush v. Gore, and find out how a statistical tie in the Florida vote count put the nation into an unprecedented holding pattern, during which American voters waited with bated breath to find out whether Al Gore or George W. Bush would be the next president of the United States. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The nightmare is now fully underway. You're in a maximum security prison. Is it as bad as people think it is?
Yeah, it is. It is. You're living in a 6 by 9 foot cell. It's very small. I mean, I could stretch out my hands and almost touch the cell walls.
And there's two of you in there?
Well, there was one. And there was two. Throughout my years, I would be forced to be with someone else. But in the beginning, I was by myself. They didn't have double bunking in the beginning of my incarceration.
And so there you are, facing the possibility of spending the rest of your life there. And then things took a very interesting turn. And this is a story, again, one of the many things that makes your story so unique and makes you such an inspiring character to me. So your story is national news, right? It got a lot of coverage. I mean, there's a lot of murders at this time, but your story got a lot of coverage.
Fernando Bermudez. 5 people testified against him, and the judge put him away for life. But was he wrongly convicted of murder?
Fernando Bermudez had an alibi. He says he was driving around with friends. There was no physical evidence against him, no blood, no gun, but there was no getting around those witnesses.
Marianne DeBerry, with the father's help, was able to track down all the witnesses who testified against Fernando and get them to admit that, under pressure, they gave false testimony.
And so then you received a letter. Let's talk about this, because this is really, and you wrote a lot of letters, but this letter that came in, You probably remember the pretty well what it said, right?
Well, absolutely. I was in my cell and I was working out, and I just finished writing another legal letter because I was always writing letters to try to get help. And a young lady wrote me. She had saw my case. She was living in Oklahoma at the time, and she wrote me and she said she believed in me. She said that she wanted to pray for me, and I was just amazed at her persistence in continuing a relationship with me. And
she had to go to some trouble to find you. It wasn't like they gave your address on the TV show.
Oh, no. Yeah, she had to investigate. At the time, there was no internet and things like that. And so she had to go. She was working for the phone company, so she had to actually call places. And finally, she called Rikers Island, and they got so fed up with her after calling so many different departments. They already had heard about her that they just scribbled off some numbers and, you know, some more information than what she was able to see on the TV, apart from my name. And then she wrote me a letter.
So you get this letter, and there was no picture attached, right?
No.
So as far as you knew, it could have been anybody, but just you didn't know that this was going to be the woman of your dreams at the time, right?
That's right.
But then things progressed.
That's right. She sent me a picture, and she was beautiful, apart from her description. And most importantly to me was that she brought the word of God in my life. I mean, I was at a point where I didn't know what to believe anymore. The American criminal justice system had failed me. I felt that God had abandoned me. And here was this young girl speaking about God to me and bringing about faith, you know, renewing it. And that's what she did. And she came to visit me, and we got married.
You got married at the prison?
In prison. So I couldn't believe it.
Wow.
That was...
And that's Crystal. Now, Crystal is I've met Crystal several times. She's an amazing person, beautiful, has such a great disposition, so positive. And then you had kids.
Yes.
While you were in prison.
Yes.
And your daughter was born in, what, 96, 95?
In the early 90s. Right. And then we had our second daughter, who was born in 2001, followed by my son in 2005.
So as much as it's a blessing to have kids and have another reason to live, right, and to be, motivated to get out of bed every day, when you're in this impossible situation, how difficult is that to grow up apart from your kids? And how does that affect them when their dad is, you know, not accessible to them?
Well, it was an extremely difficult decision for myself, because first I told Chris, we shouldn't get married. You know, you really even shouldn't bother with me, because I don't know when I'm getting out.
You don't know if you're getting out.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. And so she was like, I have faith in God that it's going to turn out. And then came the decision to have kids. For me, I didn't want to have kids because I didn't want to bring more burdens to not only ourselves in the situation we were in, but if I didn't get out, then the children would essentially almost be fatherless, apart from me being alive in prison, you know, if I survived. But also, I was so angry at the system and what it did to me and the confines and controls that I found myself in, that I said to myself, wow, you have to do something that means if you have a kid, that can survive if you don't. So it was that decision as well.
Yeah. No, and listen, it was a great decision because you have a wonderful family. You have three kids, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So then let's talk about how you, so when things turned for the better and how you did get out. What was the tipping point when you, who was it, what organization or person or combination of things? And then let's take it through when you were released.
Well, the foundation of my case leading to my exoneration, upon which all the good intention and, you know, well-spoken lawyers who fought hard for my case, the foundation begins with Mary Ann DeBarry, who was a former nun turned attorney in her late 40s, who began investigating my case as early as 1993, 1992, and so forth. And she began investigating my case, and she started laying the foundation of all the misconduct that occurred and everything. And even though I was denied 10 appeals, you know, with her help and all the different lawyers, including Hellerstein, you know, and God rest Marianne's soul as she passed away last year. The tipping point became around 2008 when I had gotten help from another attorney from Seton Hall Law School, and she was involved in my case, and she got what many prisoners would call a dream team, including lawyers from Washington, D.C., New York law firms and other people from New Jersey as well. And she also got involved in New York's Innocence Project. And together we all went into court in 2009 after I had rejected a plea bargain from the district attorney's office. So for me, that was a turning point because I finally got to test the evidence before a new judge in Manhattan State Supreme Court. And it was a moment where I felt good because I had rejected a plea bargain, an offer plea. But I was also scared because it meant that if I had lost this 11th appeal, I would definitely, or most likely, I should say, die in prison.
Wow, that's an unbelievable amount of pressure. And an Alford plea, for those of you who aren't aware, means that the state basically comes to you and says, they kind of give you like a wink, right? Like, we kind of know we messed this up, but we're not going to admit that we're wrong, which means you can't sue us, but we're going to let you go home. So, that's a tough decision to make, right? I mean, as bad as you want to get out of there, but at the same time, it's sort of like a Sophie's choice, but it's a brutal decision to have to make, but you made the right decision. And yours was not a DNA case because it was a shooting. So there was no physical evidence at the time. There was actually no physical evidence of any kind that connected you to the crime.
None whatsoever.
Never was.
Never.
Once upon a time, Amazon Music met audiobooks, and listeners everywhere rejoiced.
Oh, yeah.
Because now they could listen to one audiobook title a month from an enormous library of popular audiobook titles, including romanticy, autobiographies, true crime, and more. Suddenly, listeners didn't mind sitting in traffic or even missing their flight. Amazon Music Unlimited now includes Audible.
No way.
Download the Amazon Music app now to start listening. Terms apply.
In the aftermath of a transformative election like the one we just had, it's hard to read the news without asking yourself every 5 seconds, how did we get here? That's exactly what we're always trying to figure out on Fiasco, a history podcast from the co-creators of Slow Burn. In our first season, Bush v. Gore, we examine an unmistakable turning point in American politics, the 2000 election, which came down to a recount in Florida and ended with one of the most controversial rulings in Supreme Court history. In many ways, it's the beginning of the story we're living through right now. So if you're trying to make sense of the present moment, check out Fiasco, Bush v. Gore, and find out how a statistical tie in the Florida vote count put the nation into an unprecedented holding pattern, during which American voters waited with bated breath to find out whether Al Gore or George W. Bush would be the next president of the United States. Listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
So you go to trial with this dream team, Innocence Project lawyers, group of dedicated individuals, and now you got the odds a little bit in your favor, right? It's fair to say. And so you go to court. Let's talk about the opposite experience. You're there, same, you know, different kind of pressure, right? You've been through everything that they could throw at you. What happens?
Well, I'm in court and I'm just like glad that I rejected that offer because I really wanted to get down to the matter of these witnesses coming forward.
An NBC News investigation shows if those witnesses are now telling the truth, then Fernando Bermudez is the wrong man.
Your kids are there. Your wife is there.
My wife was there, and a lot of the past lawyers throughout the years were there as well. Marianne was actually in a cave in Israel praying for me. She went out. She was already out there, and the hearing came, and she was just there, and she sent word that she'd be praying in a cave.
Okay.
And so that was good. I felt confident with that, and we were there in the evidentiary hearing under the leadership of Barry Pollack from Washington, D.C. It went well. It went well. I mean, the detective, I don't know what kind of problems he's had in his past, but he did have, for example, past arrests for drunk driving in which he hit two girls. He came into the courtroom seemingly drunk. The prosecutor, who up until this point was so smug and confident in his position about his case against me, now was shaken, visibly shaken. They brought in a surprise detective who they said would now testify that he was observing the witnesses and that they were not engaged in the illegal identification procedures, which we already were on the verge of proving. and he couldn't remember any details. So it's like they even made a mistake bringing him in because he couldn't remember.
Because everybody could see he was lying.
Yeah. And we demonstrated through cross-examination. So I was just like, wow, all this is finally coming to the point where my faith told me that my enemies would become my footstool.
Wow, that's strong.
And that's what was happening. That's what was happening.
And this was a judge, not a jury.
This was before a judge.
Right.
And after a two-week proceeding, I waited a month because the judge says he needed more time to make the decision. And I was like, wow, I was stuck at Downstate Correctional Facility starving. I mean, I was so hungry. I was actually taking rations from the mess hall and saving it in my cell like a squirrel just to get through because there I was like in between my regular prison and Rikers waiting to be called back to court. So it was crazy. I came back to court and it was the big moment. This was my 11th appeal. I walked into the courtroom and there was just like a hushed suffocation. All you could hear was the whirl of recorders, of television cameras, reporters furiously scribbling. You could hear people breathing. The clock seemed to be just ticking so slow. You could just hear the tick, 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 tick. And I was just like, I was nervous because this was a moment. And finally, the judge asked me to stand. And I stood and my knees were shaking. I felt a touch of global warming under my shirt. I was just so nervous, and the judge declared me actually innocent. And the courtroom erupted in applause, and then the judge didn't stop there. He said that in this case, the prosecutor, James G. Rodriguez, knew and should have known that he was relying upon perjured testimony, wow, that the identification procedures were illegal and constitutional and should not have occurred, which a federal judge had previously ruled in my favor on. And that the state of New York admitted that its state star witness, Ephraim Lopez, had committed perjury, and he declared me actually innocent.
Fernando Bermudez was falsely accused of murder after a fight outside a Manhattan nightclub. He was convicted, though, sent to prison, exonerated, then released after nearly 20 years when a judge found misconduct in his case.
This wrongful conviction was predicated upon perjury, was predicated upon manipulation, was predicated upon coercion and deceit of New York City District Attorney's Office and New York City Police Department.
And then you walked out of the courtroom a free man. TV cameras there, everything,
yes,
right?
Yes, yes. Soon after that, I walked out.
And that must have been a crazy mixture of emotions, too. I mean, your wife is there. You're able to hug her like a normal person, like a man, not in any, with nobody overseeing you or watching or anything else, right? But then you're out in the fresh air. And, like, what's going through your mind?
Well, I was scared because the world had changed so much. I mean,
about 18 years.
18 and a half years, several presidents and governors later. I mean, now there was the internet. People were walking around.
Cell phones.
Yeah. They were walking. Before I went to prison, the cell phones were the size of shoe boxes, assuming you even had one.
Yeah.
You know, it was very rare, you know, and now everyone had one. People were talking to themselves on the street. I realized it was Bluetooth technology. The fashion had changed from baggy pants to now skinny jeans. Besides that, I was just scared because I didn't even feel like I had permission to be outside. I was psychologically.
Were you worried that they were going to send you back in, that this was all a dream, or that someone was going to grab you and go, no, you could go back to your cell, whatever? Was that a thought?
Well, I certainly felt that this can happen again.
Right.
I felt that, but I had trouble crossing the street. I got dizzy in department stores because there were so many colors and choices.
It's like a PTSD kind of.
Well, then that's when I realized. After a while, I said, well, what's wrong with me? Why am I waking up in the middle of the night, getting up and feeling like I'm still in a prison cell, pacing? And Crystal would tell me, you know, you got to get back to bed. You're not in prison anymore. You know, walking the family dog at that time was an issue. I felt like there was gun towers outside. I mean, it was just a lot of stuff. So I realized after I went to psychiatric evaluation that I had post-traumatic stress disorder, and I didn't think I would have that.
Well, you served, you know, in the DNA exoneration cases with homicide as a crime, the average time served is 13 years. So you served, significantly longer than the average one, although we had a couple of recent exonerations of guys who had served 34 years, which is an unbelievable number. It's almost twice as long. But it affects everyone differently, and it obviously is going to infect anybody to go through this. So I think, and it's interesting, too, thinking back to that scene in the courtroom. You know, the odds are stacked against you when you're poor, when you're Latino or of color, right? We know that a higher percentage of people of color are arrested, are prosecuted, are convicted. There's no justification for that. There's no evidence that they commit crimes at a higher rate or anything else. And so you finally got the scales of justice tipped in your favor, and you emerged to this loving family. But then you still had another lawsuit to go, right? You still had a case. Now you had to file a suit against the city and against the state, right?
Yes.
So that has now been resolved, right? The first one.
The first one, but it took me 5.5 years, let the record reflect.
5.5 years. So you're out with nothing for 5.5 years.
Nothing.
No job skills, no resume, how to get a job, right? It's got to be brutal.
I mean, all I had was, an associate's degree, the concentration in business, and working toward my bachelor's. And then when I got out, I had to go to college to finish my bachelor's, and I had to take loans. There was no free ride here. I had to go to college and out there, and, like most hardworking young men and women do for their lives and futures. But the thing is, I had to deal with the psychological impact. I didn't know how to drive anymore. I had to get a license. People from my church closed me. They helped me get my license back. I didn't have money to get a license or even take driving school lessons. It was funny. I'm 40 years old and I got to learn how to drive again.
No, it's interesting, Fernando. Almost 35% of exonerees don't get any money, right? Because the compensation statutes are so different in every state. And some states it's impossible to get money. Some it's very difficult to get money. And I think people think that you come out and society just opens its doors to you and everything's great and you get a check and you move on with your life. But 5.5 years with nothing, struggling on the outside. I knew you back then and I know what you were going through. That's got to be just another, almost another major challenge to get through. But you got through it. I mean, you persevered. I know you went and did 300 speaking engagements. We talked about that before. Just by cold calling, you've spoken all over the world.
Yes. We've been to Japan, Italy, Germany, France, Switzerland. We tell our story far and wide to transform the criminal justice systems.
So, Fernando, what I wanted to ask you is, what's the message you want to send?
Well, certainly the problem of wrongful convictions is far-reaching. We have over 1,700 wrongful convictions that are just documented, and that's just documented in America today.
Well, yeah, 1,700 exonerations. I think it's almost...
Yes.
Close to 1,800, yeah.
Absolutely, close to 1,800 exonerations. Those are just the ones that are documented. And, over almost 150 were released from death row, which is, horrible as well. And
no, that's what Brian Stevenson says. I mean, for every person we've executed, for every 9 people we've executed, we've had 1 exonerated from death row. And as he says, and he's one of my heroes, if you had planes and 1 out of every 9 or 10 planes crashed, nobody would fly. You can't have this system. So anyway, I'm sorry to interrupt you. So go ahead.
So on that note, there has to be accountability. Prosecutors get this immunity. We understand that we need prosecutors and those who do a good job, kudos to them. But for those that don't, who flout the system and our Constitution, then shame on them. They should be held accountable. They have too much immunity. We need more accountability for those who are responsible as a deterrent effect. Law is created to deter crime across the board. And if it doesn't deter crime or misconduct, then it doesn't work. Why is a law there?
Right. So we need laws. Why are they above the law?
Right. So they shouldn't be. And, the damage that it causes families and the people directly affected by the incarceration is horrible. I mean, I'm affected today. I'm still free today, but I still feel like I'm in prison.
For people who want to help, what can they do? Should they go online? Should they write letters? Should they donate?
Well, I think that the public needs to connect with their politicians and voice their concerns that this is an issue that matters to them. But more than that, they also need to, like, if possible, to use their resources, talents, and time to volunteer to their local innocence projects.
Well, that's, you know, great. There are 55 innocence projects around the country, and so there's probably one near you, wherever you are.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcast in association with Signal Company No. 1.
You've done it again, finance teams. You closed the books and it went fine. Sure, some expenses were missing receipts, but that's fine. Stayed late to process invoices by hand. It's all fine. But don't you deserve better than fine? With Ramp, expenses are submitted with a text, invoices are coded automatically, and everything is connected to your accounting system so you can close the books without all the busy work. Switch your business to ramp.com and love finance again.